You're listening to a stage talk titled A Collaborative Model for Big Impact with Local Investigations. This week we were joined by Sam Stecklow from the award-winning Invisible Institute. Before the Institute, Sam was an editor with the Southside Weekly for over 7 years, a journalist on a collaborative team between the Salt Lake Tribune and PBS Frontline that investigated police shootings throughout Utah, and a Freedom of Information Act consultant for organizations such as Preservation Chicago and the Chicago Independent Media Alliance. His reporting and editing has won and been a finalist for many local and national awards. During the talk, he spoke about the Invisible Institute, though, and the impact they've had with their Civic Police Data Project, amongst other investigations. Sam has been the lead Freedom of Information Act journalist there since 2018, which is a vital part of their work. Dana, Sam's colleague, was also due to appear on this talk, but unfortunately was diagnosed with COVID at the time of recording. You can find all the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by Giancarlo Fiorella on Thursday, the 1st of August, 2024, in the Bellingcat Discord server.
Today we are joined by Sam Stecklow from the Invisible Institute for this week's Stage Talk. The Invisible Institute is a Chicago-based nonprofit newsroom with two Pulitzer Prizes and a Peabody Award for their very impactful human rights reporting. The organization prides itself on collaborative methods with local community members, media outlets, and legal networks to tell innovative, data-heavy investigations. What we hope that you'll get from this talk is useful information for anybody out there who is looking to make an impact with locally focused open source research, and for anybody who is interested in human rights issues, particularly related to injustices against minority communities. So first of all, Sam, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I now hand over the microphone to you for your talk. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Sam Stecklow. I'm a journalist with the Invisible Institute. I've been here since about 2017. I work on a lot of our kind of public records focused projects and reporting. So that's our kind of public data tools as well as our reporting. And so I think the easiest way to talk about the kind of work that we do now is to kind of go through a little bit of the history of the organization, which is very much tied into the recent history of Chicago. So I'm going to share my screen. I don't have a presentation. I have a collection of links that I will share out afterwards. So our story kind of starts with a woman named Diane Bond, who's seen here in this photo. She was a resident of the Stateway Gardens Public Housing Project in Chicago. It was on what was called the State Street Corridor in Chicago, which up until the 90s was one of the densest concentrations of public housing in the country. There were several high-rise public housing units all up and down State Street in the south side of Chicago. And in the 90s, the Second Daley administration started to tear down these projects as part of what they called the Plan for Transformation. But there was ultimately not really any real plan. There was just a plan to tear down these projects and then nowhere for really these people to go or for what would happen to them. And so kind of in the interim, as they were, undertaking the Plan for Transformation, there were still many thousands of people living in these projects like Stateway Gardens. And the police force that, controlled and policed that area was very notorious. They ended up being known as the Skullcap Crew. And they would allow, open-air drug markets to exist in these housing projects, taking payoffs from the people who ran those. At the same time, they would harass, assault, shake down, all of the residents of the project who, were just trying to live their lives there. So Diane Bond was a woman who was repeatedly victimized by these Chicago police officers, to the point where she enlisted the help of the person who ended up being the founder of Invisible Institute, Jamie Kelvin, who was working as a public housing tenant advocate at Stateway Gardens. And so he would help folks like Diane to file misconduct complaints against the Chicago Police Department. And so that he would see, and they would all see, that these would kind of very quickly go nowhere. The complaints were investigated by the immediate supervisors of the officers. They would often not talk to the complainant at all. And ultimately there would be no accountability through this system. There was a lawsuit that, over the course of that lawsuit, there were these lists of officers and misconduct that were created. And Jamie Kelvin eventually filed to intervene as a journalist in this lawsuit that was brought, which is not something that's particularly done often. And even, you know, done even more rarely is when the judge allows that to happen. But he was allowed to intervene as a journalist and argue for the public access of these misconduct complaints that up until then were essentially completely secret in Chicago and in Illinois. And so that set off about another decade of litigation that resulted in an appellate court finding in Illinois called Kelvin versus Chicago. And so that is ultimately a precedential decision that states that almost all records about police misconduct, complaints, and investigations in Illinois are public records. And so with that, we were able to go to the Chicago Police Department and argue that not only were the records public, but the underlying data about all of their misconduct, complaints, and investigations is also public. And so we were kind of able to also do that through a more public push that came as a result of the protests around the Quan McDonald shooting in Chicago. And that was also something that our kind of deep ties to the community allowed us to report on, because what ultimately allowed the story to break was that Jamie received tips from people who worked in law enforcement that the shooting, which you might be familiar with, Laquan McDonald was a 16-year-old who was shot 16 times in Chicago. That was initially reported as, you know, he had lunged at the officer and there was, you know, nothing more to investigate until we were leaked that autopsy, information about the autopsy report that showed he had been shot 16 times front and back. And so kind of with the reporting that we were able to do and the existing community ties through this work that had been done with the Stateway Gardens residents and many others who were impacted by policing around that time, we built a database, a public website for the Chicago police misconduct complaints that we were able to obtain through that Kelvin v. Chicago complaint or a court decision. And so this, you know, there have been certainly many kind of cop watching projects, many projects to identify officers and track them. But in terms of being able to access the full underlying misconduct and use of force data from a police department, certainly the size of Chicago, was not something that had been done before in the U.S. In 2016, we launched the Citizens Police Data Project, which still houses decades of misconduct complaints. We're in the process of updating it up to last year in anticipation of the DNC protest, which it will certainly be used a lot. We are able to engage with a really wide variety of different kinds of folks through this. So we work often with journalists who are utilizing either the underlying data or this as a search tool to look at officers, but very often it's also attorneys, it's also activists who are essentially interacting with an officer on the street. We've seen, you know, protests, folks will use our, you know, our mobile site and search officers who they're interacting with and be able to say, you have X number of complaints, you know, in your file. But it also kind of broadens our ability to talk to folks who are impacted by policing as well, because we're able to go to them and not only have a discussion about the negative experience that they had, but also be able to tie it back into a larger context that they are almost certainly well aware of, but might not immediately have the data or information to kind of paint that larger picture. And so part of that work is something that we do called the Youth Police Project. It's gone through a few iterations over the years, but it was a program with Hyde Park Academy High School, which is very close to our office in Chicago, where journalists, organizers that we worked with, you know, many other kind of non-journalist lawyers would work alongside a law clinic at UChicago and with these students at Hyde Park Academy to really kind of put together programming for the students, but also there was a conference paper that came out of this that really kind of described what the youth police experience is in Chicago from the youth perspective, and that was something that they were all able to have authorship in and present. And so through kind of all of this, I think something that we kind of view our role as being is kind of this connection point between more traditional journalists, where we kind of will publish, investigative news articles, including one, The Code of Silence, which was one that Jamie worked on for a number of years that exposed a lot of the police misconduct at Stateway Gardens while the time that Diane Bond was being harassed, to a Mauled series. This is called Mauled, as in police dogs, where we were obtaining some data about use of force in Indianapolis. We saw that there was some other public data that really hadn't been mined, and we were able to take our kind of data journalism work with the Indy Star in Indianapolis, who were on the ground, and able to really fully report that out, and then partnered with Marshall Project as well. But it also kind of allows us to expand outside of kind of what is maybe more traditional journalism. And so I'm sure you're all familiar with forensic architecture. We were able to work with them on this investigation that was, you know, again, published as a traditional written piece with The Intercept, but also this exhibit and this kind of very detailed breakdown on various different kinds of time, so by the week, by the minute, by the second, to get down to the split second decision that's often cited by police as the reason for why they needed to commit a fatal shooting. In this case, there was one in Chicago of a barber named Grace Augustus, who was walking down the street, interacted with officers. They thought he had a concealed weapon and shot him. And so, you know, this could have existed simply as a written investigation. But we were also able to kind of take it outside of that format with the partnerships that we're able to create. Obviously not something that's fully unique to us. You know, the New York Times and other folks do work like this now as well. But I think the connection that we were able to bring kind of specifically between forensic architecture and a lot of the organizers that we were directly communicating with on the ground is something that I do think is unique to us. I think maybe the most exciting and also one of the most applicable maybe to this audience project that we have is called Beneath the Surface. This is a project that takes a lot of the misconduct complaints, documents, narratives that we have, and in partnership with a wide community of volunteers who went through and read, coded, analyzed a lot of the paper records and written narratives that we had obtained, then trained an algorithm that known as Judy to kind of help show where there were gaps in specifically missing persons investigations in Chicago. And that's being used now to kind of expand into other kind of gender-based violence and also other kind of gaps that exist in the official data. Because as much as we, you know, rely and utilize the official data that we get, we know it is at the same time, you know, extremely limited. And so that kind of data work directly led to one of our Pulitzer Prize projects, Missing in Chicago, which kind of was able to show not only the human impact of missing people and specifically missing Black women and girls in Chicago, but also really dig down into the police are, for example, saying they're closing, you know, X number of cases as, having been investigated, or sometimes even that someone was murdered, and sometimes they were still alive at the time when that was reported by, or they were dead and they were still alive at the time when the police wrote that. And so it was almost a foregone conclusion that they created. The other kind of way that we're working to kind of build out our work is through trying to go outside of the city of Chicago, right? And so we know that misconduct certainly doesn't end at city limits. And so we've been trying to think about how do we work with local organizations, local community partners in other parts of Illinois and other parts of the country. And so we started first in Illinois, because that's where we know the law the best and we have the most kind of partners. And we have been building smaller versions of our data tool in partnership with local journalists and local community organizations for a lot of feedback and kind of user testing for use of police misconduct data, use of force data, in smaller places than Chicago. And it's a different kind of question. It's a different kind of utility. But it's a question that we're really hoping to explore, because obviously most cities are not the size of Chicago. And if we want to be able to have this kind of transparency, standard, not even, you know, us bringing that standard everywhere, but kind of set a standard, we need to kind of show, the level that it can be done at, which is certainly not the same level as Chicago. The second part of that is working to obtain police employment history data at the state level. And this is what helps us show officers who move around to different departments. And so obviously this has been in the news a lot lately, unfortunately, with the killing of Sonya Massey. The officer had worked at six departments over the course of 4 years and had misconduct at several of them, which is something that us and other outlets have been able to report, partially because of the records that were established as public in the Calvin decision. Finally, in terms of work that we don't kind of directly do, we kind of see the data transparency standard for police misconduct records broadening. In 2019, there was a consent decree that was brought in Chicago to reform the department. And part of that is that a lot of records and data about misconduct complaints about use of force has to be made expressly public. The city police oversight agency has actually gone beyond that and had done so before and maintains a full case portal, which is not perfect technologically, but it allows for and publishes thousands of documents about police misconduct cases just as a matter of course, as part of what they do. And they actually have to have a judge sign an order if they want to not publish records from a case. There has to be a specific reason not to. And so that would not have happened had we not brought the original case, right? If you compare what the situation was before the Calvin decision, say, and when they were implementing the policy, there was almost no transparency around this kind of data. So of course, you know, we can't say that we are the sole, you know, we can't take full responsibility, but it's very easy to look at the timeline and say this data would not have been made public had we not pushed for it to be so. And we see that being cited in other places like New York, California, Maryland, where a lot of other laws are being passed to open up police misconduct records And so, I think that's kind of the arc of our work, with journalists, with community members, with legal networks. But, it's a very brief overview. So I'm happy to dive into any more of this, and I'll turn it over to everyone.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, for this really interesting talk. I want to open up the floor to our chat. If you're listening to this, please feel free to ask questions in the chat. You can ask Sam about anything that he's presented about. I have a couple of Sam for you while we get people warmed up here in the chat. So, I wasn't familiar with this with your work previous to this talk. I studied criminology in university, and the CPDP website is, I think, is fantastic. What a slap in the face it is to see these numbers that you have on the site about the repeat offenders of police officers who have multiple, like many, many dozens of allegations made against them. So, for example, there's one officer here who has 117 allegations against them, and only four of them have been sustained. There's another one here who has 175 allegations, and only six of them have been sustained. There's a whole list of them. There's one with 91, and there's been no allegations that have been sustained. So, first of all, thank you for, you know, this project, because again, it's such an impactful graphic to see these numbers. And I just want to ask you, you know, how do you make sense of this? What do you think? How is this is probably a doctoral thesis right here, but when you look at this and you work through this data, what are you thinking? What's happening here?
I mean, ultimately it's unfortunately a system working as intended, right? Like, going all the way back to when the first civilian oversight body in Chicago was created, which was the Office of Professional Standards, in the 70s, the administrators gave an interview with the internal, CPD magazine, and they gave some kind of, estimated statistic of, we'll have, you know, maybe 10% of, cases that are sustained, or we've had sustained findings. And that kind of held true. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy for a very long time, where there were many, many parts of the system that existed to prevent specifically citizen complaints from being disciplined. Because once you really dig down into the data, you see that most of the discipline comes from internal complaints. So like a supervisor bringing some kind of case against one of their officers who work under them. And so once you really get into like, how often are citizen complaints sustained? Do they find a verifying misconduct? It's even lower. And so for a very long time in Illinois, there was a requirement that an affidavit had to be signed by the complainant. And there were many studies and anecdotal cases showing that this really discouraged people from filing complaints. And often if there was a serious case and they had a civil attorney, the attorney would discourage them from participating in the process, because it often would just not go their way. And there was really no benefit to them, because the officer would never discipline. And so that affidavit requirement was eventually lifted. But if you dive into these old cases, you'll see often the complainant was never interviewed, which was something that came up often in Jamie's reporting back in the 90s, continued. We still see cases where, you know, a case is dropped because, we couldn't get, you know, the full kind of cooperation from the complainant, when there still might have been information that they could have gone and investigated. And then even when there is discipline, like they sustain a case, they bring discipline, it goes through that whole legal review, then of course there's the police department superintendent can decide to disagree with that, send it to a review by the police board if they want to escalate it that high. Or the officer, after they've, you know, been disciplined, everyone agrees with it, they can bring an appeal, a grievance, they can go to arbitration, and they can bring that all the way, you know, through the court system. A lot of the time the discipline does get overturned. There are just so many parts of the system that don't want complaints to be sustained. But that there definitely has been a change in recent years. And that's not necessarily reflected in the data that you see because it ends in 2018. But there have been some more recent analyses that show that the sustain rate, you know, it's not a straight line up or anything, nor would you expect it to be, but have been some significant changes and a lot of more public kind of contention between the civilian oversight board or agency and the CPD superintendent over the amount of discipline that they're trying to bring.
Mm, yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you, Sam. We have a question here from one of our community members, Jessica. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for your question. Jessica's asking, what resources have you found useful so far when trying to investigate police misconduct outside of Chicago and outside of Illinois?
It really will. I mean, so you have kind of official sources, right? Or and then human sources, right? So in terms of like official documentation and stuff like that, it varies so much on the state, as I'm sure anybody who uses state public records laws knows. You know, something that is public in one, you know, city on the border will not be on, you know, right across the state line. And so that can go for certainly misconduct records, which vary really wildly by state, but also just like simple police reports. There are some states where you can't get, you know, anything that's not like an arrest report or something like that. Where they're like a criminal investigation, you can't get things like that. You have to really rely on court records. And so, it's really kind of trying to avail yourself of all of the possible sources that might exist. So PACER or state court documents. And then in terms of human sources, you know, public defenders are always usually pretty happy to talk about the problems with police in their area. So that's usually my first stop.
Great. Thank you for that answer. We have another one here from another community member. It's 526-101. Hi, 526-101. Thanks for your question and thanks for coming to the talk. And before I get to the question, I just want to, it's related to, I think, a theme of your talk, which is working with community members and working with, you know, people outside of journalism. So you're doing this very impactful work. You're doing work that directly involves the people who you're reporting about and the issues that you're reporting have really, you know, direct connections to the people that are involved in these projects. And so 526-101 is asking a question that we actually get a lot here at Bellingcat, because I'm not sure if you know, but we also kind of lean heavily into the community aspect of investigative research. And the question that 526-101 is asking is saying, hey, you know, this is my first time here and I'm thinking, how can I help? Where should I start? What advice do you have, Sam, for anyone who's listening, who's looking to get started investigating injustices in their local area using the open source information and the information that you work with?
I think that's a great question. I think I would point kind of to a similar answer, honestly, of look into what records are accessible in your area. And so if you can start making a request for, you know, I want to see what happens when there's a use of force in my city. I want to see how often the police are overturning their discipline. You know, if there's some specific issue that you're familiar with, whether it's maybe related to housing or mental health or some other thing that interacts with policing, kind of really try to think about like what is the what is the root cause, but like what can I get to show that this is a problem that I already know about or already have some kind of idea about. And maybe that's just like, you know, that police misconduct is a problem in general and you want to see what those records look like. And so, you know, public records requests are a good start. I think court records are also a good way to go. In PACER, the federal court database for the U.S., you can search by, you know, just the name of the department or the name of the town or the county or whatever it may be, and try and look at complaints that have been filed, lawsuits that have been filed. I think another way is to go and observe just regular court sessions, open court criminal or misdemeanor court, because I think you'll see It'll be very, very eye-opening. You can see even if there isn't something, you know, really sensationalistic happening, you might notice like, oh, wow, that to me seems like a really harsh punishment for whatever that crime was, even though it's not being treated as some kind of misconduct in the courtroom. And so you can bring, you know, that kind of perspective to it. And then finally, I think just the kind of human forces of people who work with folks who are most impacted by police misconduct and police violence. And so public defenders is an immediate one, or other kind of criminal defense attorneys, but also legal aid organizations often, you know, who are assisting folks with housing or other kind of issues like that. A lot of the time, those are similar populations that are dealing with police harassment or police misconduct. And other kinds of service providers, you know, it really depends. Sometimes there's a very close tie between a certain kind of service provider and a law enforcement agency. So it's, you know, use your kind of street smarts on that. But, you know, really kind of trying to think about, like, who is most impacted by this in my community and who talks to them.
Thanks, Sam. Folks, if you're listening to this, you can ask a question in the chat. Don't be shy. I am monitoring the chat here and the moderators are as well. So please feel free to ask Sam questions. I have another one, Sam. As you were talking during your presentation, it struck me that you know, you work in different formats. So you have the map, you know, you've done work with forensic architecture. One of your Pulitzer Prizes, I understand, is for audio reporting. And so you seem to have this flexibility at this, at your organization to experiment and to work in different mediums. And so my question is, how do you decide what is the best format to tell a particular investigation?
That's a great question. I think we really feel it out, you know. I think everything that we do, everything that we do is in partnership with some other organization. And so we are always kind of trying to think about how we kind of present things, as part of those partnerships. And so, you know, within our team, we have, you know, kind of more traditional, journalists like myself. We have data journalists, we have technologists, we have, audio reporters. We have, you know, engagement folks, and I think we all kind of at some stage of a project, we all kind of engage with what it looks like. And we are all kind of able to bring kind of our strength. And so the, you know, the audio, reporting, I'm glad you brought that up because I think I missed that. Our project, You Didn't See Nothing, and then our previous podcast, Somebody, I think are really, really good examples of how the kind of human storytelling of what we do can kind of come out, and in a way that, and I'm sure, you know, anybody who engages with audio kind of reporting on that, you know, there's a much kind of more direct connection to the storytelling than, you know, potentially reading a print investigation, right? Not all written work, but it allows for a different kind of depth, but we're also able to bring the same amount of research. And if there is, you know, any kind of other data, you know, to kind of bring to bear about it, but often it's, you know, maybe archival work or other kinds of skills that we might not even have directly within our team. Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that, but I think we like to think about all of the options that are, you know, that are available to us, and use them when they make sense, which is not a great answer.
Well, no, but it's a very practical one, right? Like, what is it that we're trying to do? How are we trying to tell it? And then, yeah. So to, you know, thinking back a bit about the Civic Police Data Project, can you maybe tell us a bit more about why is it that you started to focusing on police data projects, number one? So what was it that kind of drove you to that kind of reporting in the first place? And also, is there anything else you can tell us about some of the impactful moments that have come out of the reporting that you've done on police data?
Yeah, so I mean, the organization was really founded upon receipt, like obtaining this data from the Chicago Police Department. You know, I talked about Jamie's reporting and things like that in the 90s. There really was no Invisible Institute, right? The reporting he was doing was published in a newsletter called View from the Ground. And the kind of in-joke really was that it was just him. It was published under the auspices of the Invisible Institute because there was no institute. Through kind of the natural progression of that reporting and legal and advocacy work over, you know, decades, that kind of became the organization that was created, when we received that data from the city. And I should be clear, I wasn't there, at the time, but, I think the thing that kind of draws us to it is that obviously it's very useful for journalism and for doing kind of analysis on the big problem and like being able to look at talk about the problem in a larger way and pull these numbers out and show patterns and things like that and things that journalists and researchers want to do. But at the end of the day, that's not particularly useful to someone who is experiencing police misconduct, either, as part of a pattern or in the moment or witnessing it at a protest or something like that. Part of our mission statement is, I'm going to butcher this, but kind of enhancing the capacity of citizens to hold public institutions accountable. I think journalism is one way to do that, to kind of use our tools and our knowledge and expertise to expose things that allow people to use that reporting and that information, the reporting, to hold public institutions accountable, but also just like making the underlying data usable, available, downloadable for people who do have that level of expertise, but just searchable and, browsable for everybody else who doesn't, including me. I think that's a really big part of why we have this like public facing approach. We want to do the work that we think needs to be done for sure, but we also know that we're not the sole arbiters of like what work needs to be done. And this information has so much value to so many people who are not us. And it would be, it would feel wrong to not work to make that as public as possible. Another part of that.
Thanks, I think there's I'm going to ask you another question that is a sort of a follow-up to that second one that you forgot about, which is fine. But, you're talking about, the importance of doing this kind of work and having it out there for folks to be able to actually look at and work with and put into some kind of action, in their own communities. And my previous question, and I want to ask you about now is how do citizens get involved with your projects beyond, having a great resource through your work that they can download and then maybe, conduct some action based on that? Are they involved in previous stages? Could you tell us more about how you work with individuals on projects like this?
Sure. So I think the most direct way there are a few, but the what I was going to say is the kind of community review process that Beneath the Surface utilizes. And so again, that's our director of data, Trina Reynolds Tyler. She has been utilizing a bunch of the data, but also a lot of just like the full text of the investigation, records that we've been receiving, working with a group of volunteers that she assembled. And I can't get more detailed than this, but was able to utilize their expertise just in their lives and in the community, reading these files to train an algorithm to then find other cases of that are hidden within the data. And specifically what I mean is we'll often see that something like for example, a woman complains that she might have been violated during like a pat down or something like that, it'll get categorized as an illegal search, which is really like they didn't have grounds to search me, not I was violated during the process of the search. That's a different thing. But it'll get categorized as an illegal search or something else where, you know, it'll get categorized as like an operations violation, which means nothing. It's just a catch-all category. And so we have to, and if you just look at the data, you'll see it like, oh, well, you know, illegal search, you know, whatever. Maybe someone's complaining that they didn't want to go to jail. They had drugs on them and that's what it is. No, it's actually somebody who was, who regardless of whether or not like the stop was legal, whether or not they had something on them, something shouldn't have happened to them, period. And it's hidden, you know, within the data as something that might be interpreted as way more minor or way more routine or, you know, something that is maybe just to be expected. So being able to kind of show that that's happening, you know, we could see it in individual cases, but to be able to show it in a larger way, with the community of volunteers that Trina built, I think is really important. And then I think the other way is that we build into our data projects. Certainly our data projects probably a little bit more than our reporting because that follows a little bit, you know, a little bit more of a tighter, control, as you might imagine. But for our kind of more public data projects, especially when we're getting to the point, you know, a little bit further along in the process, but obviously not too far along, we engage with folks who are directly impacted, service providers, attorneys, you know, anybody who we think would make use of the tool that we're working on. We have a very extensive engagement process. So we launched our kind of second iteration of our data tool in Champaign, which is kind of downstate in Illinois. And we had several trips where we went and spoke directly with people, had events, you know, engaged directly with attorneys, with service providers, with going out and just canvassing and talking to people on the street about their experiences with the police. That really helped inform the work that we've done in expanding our data tool outside of Chicago, because we did a lot of that work kind of as a matter of course in Chicago and realized that we needed to basically replicate that in Champaign.
Thanks, Sam. That's a fascinating answer. And, you know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking a lot about, again, the work that we do at Bellingcat and how the question of who is our community and what do we mean when we say community and, you know, what does that look like at the individual level and how do we engage with folks in the way that you're describing? We share a lot of your questions. And I think, you know, when I look at the work that you guys are doing, I'm like, wow, that's exactly the kind of thing that we want to do. So it's really interesting and really inspiring. Folks, we got about 15 minutes here with Sam Steklow. If you have questions for Sam, please type them in the chat. We've got a couple come in here from the community here on our Discord server. I am going to combine two questions into one. I'm going to try to combine two questions into one. The first question is from Geist. Hi, Geist. Thank you for being here and for asking your question. And Geist is asking, and I'm going to combine it with another one. So Geist is saying, do you have any advice for collectives or organizations that are just starting off to build credibility, to have an impact, and to build partnerships? And I'm going to try to combine that with a question from the Primal Collective. And the Primal Collective is looking at your work, Sam, and they're saying, huh, I wonder if this kind of model can be applied to the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit individuals crisis. You know, basically sort of like looking at what you guys are doing with police reports in Chicago and thinking about that topic. If you were an organization or a group of folks who was looking to, for example, map this crisis, what is some advice that you would have for an organization like that to build credibility, to have an impact, and maybe to seek other organizations that are also interested in this?
Sure. So I'll start kind of backwards on that, I guess. So I think that's a really great question, and it's something that we're also, you know, thinking about. Obviously, this problem that we've identified in Chicago is not does not end at city limits, does not, you know, end at county limits. It's a regional and you know, nationwide problem that has lots of specific permutations, right? And so I don't have like a very specific kind of prescription for how I would tackle this, but in, you know, using the work that we did, I would be very curious to see, and maybe it's at the state level, maybe it's, you know, I guess across multiple states, but to see how cases that are confirmed, I guess, to be part of this phenomenon, see how they are discussed in the official record, I guess, especially earlier on, before they were confirmed. So you're looking at it after the fact and kind of see how was this categorized, how the first reports kind of come in, and what were the steps that were taken or weren't taken. And, you know, how did they eventually find out that this was, you know, I mean, I guess it's hard to say was, you know, confirmed. You know, obviously, if you go and find a case where, you know, a family has been kind of drawing attention to it for years, and it'll, again, depend on the state, but if you can get the police records and see kind of who they talked to, who they didn't talk to, I think a big part of what Trita and her reporting partner, Sarah Conway, did when they were actually going and taking these cases that were we think there's a missing person hidden in this data, going and talking to the family and realizing that the family had maybe never been spoken to by an officer after they filed their report, or there had been some really significant delay, and they, you know, they should have jumped on it much sooner. And so if you can kind of see that in a few different kinds of cases, maybe there's some kind of loophole or some kind of gap or some step that's not being taken that you can identify. And then ultimately that's, you know, that's what potentially can be used to hopefully bring some kind of change and show like, oh, no, we need to require that this step is taken. We need to make sure that this information is known. Right. That's, you know, not an immediate step, but that's kind of how these things happen. Right. You have to show not only that there is a problem, but exactly kind of where the problem lies, because a lot of the time these agencies, these, you know, legislators, whatever, they may not have the time or the interest to really go and do that work. And it may rely on, you know, outside groups, families. Sorry, I have a dog here. If you and then, you know, to kind of bring that to the other question, it took a long time, I think, for us to kind of establish that we had you know, a certain amount of trust and credibility in what we do, and I think a lot of that was tied to the work that at first Jamie did for a very long period of time and reporting on and advocating on these kinds of conditions, but also, you know, after that in kind of demonstrating our values as an organization of like, we want to bring not only, you know, expose wrongdoing and misconduct in the way that, you know, investigative reporters do, or show the really, like deep human side of, this kind of misconduct or this kind of abuse in the way that our, you know, audio journalists do. But also really like, you know, put a flag in the sand and say, like, we want to state that this should be a standard that people should expect for their police. You should be able to see if an officer that you've interacted with, has a pattern of doing something that you might've witnessed. So, I think, you know, that it happened over a long time for us. It doesn't necessarily have to, but I think Bellingcat had a similar, you know, journey as I've kind of, you know, witnessed it over the years of, simply doing the work, showing how you do the work and, you know, building your credibility that way. You know, relying on the network that you're able to build and the experts that you're able to work with. So, you know, it's, do exactly what Bellingcat did. It's not maybe the best answer for like any small collective, but I really do think starting by showing the work that you're doing is a huge step towards credibility in that kind of space.
Thanks for that answer, Sam. And, you know, thinking about similarities in the work and how we approach things, I'm going to ask you a question here. And we're just about 8 minutes away from the end of the chat here, folks. So if you have a question, now's the time to get it in. We probably have time for one or two more. But again, thinking about maybe similarities between the work that you're doing and how you're doing it and the work that we do and how we do it, I'm going to ask you a question that seems personal, but we get it all the time. And so maybe you get it all the time as well. But what does your funding model look like? And the reason I'm asking is because, you know, I'm interested, right? Because again, we seem to have similar ways of working. But also I'm asking because we've seen a huge decline in local newsrooms and funding to local newsrooms over recent years due to funding issues. And that's something that, you know, we're seeing, and I'm sure lots of other folks are seeing as well. So can you talk a little bit about what the funding model looks like for you guys?
Sure. This is not something I work directly on, but I speak a little bit to it. It's a lot of, you know, journalism, kind of nonprofit funding that you know, as long as that still exists for the moment, and also kind of looking at the kind of work that we do outside of journalism, kind of looking into more tech-wide kind of funding and things like that. But I think your point is very good in that this ecosystem is very quickly drying up, and there need to be some kinds of, you know, articulation of why these things are kind of worth funding outside of just a philanthropic model, I guess. And that's not to say that we have kind of that formula down or anything like that, but you know, there have to be kind of other bodies that pick up some responsibility for all of these nonprofit journalism funders that are kind of going belly up. I don't know what the answer is, because every kind of industry that we're tied to seems to be, you know, academia and all sorts of other things. There's questions in all of it. So I very much do not have a great answer, but I think that we try and provide a little bit of a solution to other outlets in Illinois as we're able to by working kind of directly with local reporters where there is, you know, a story that we can bring something to. And so the Sonia Massey case, where we're working with local reporters downstate, I think is the most obvious one, because there's a personal supplier, I guess, that we can bring.
And the last question here, Sam, we're about 5 minutes away from the end here. Last question is, how or have the local police forces that you've investigated, have they ever responded to your reporting? Have you ever seen a reaction from them in any way to the work that you've been doing?
I mean, there, you know, sometimes we've certainly gotten word that they're not thrilled about the story or whatever. I mean, we of course, reach out to every organization that we write about when we're publishing a story or something like that. But something that's been pretty interesting to me is that, you know, there's a kind of this ecosystem of like right-wing police friendly blog and like social media kind of sphere in Chicago that, you know, I'm sure is familiar to folks in other major cities. I've seen it, you know, in Philadelphia and places like that, where, you know, you know, villains, right? Like the progressive prosecutor, like Kim Fox, was a villain for a long time. And Lori Lightfoot, even though she was pretty pro-police, who was the mayor, was a villain for these folks for a long time, things like that. You know, knock on wood, we've never really been a villain for them. And I think it's because the commenters and kind of, you know, folks in this police side of the, you know, social media, you know, here, recognize that there is a public value in this data. They also want to be able to access data about police misconduct, about use of force. And that's something that we've heard from, you know, anecdotally from some supervisors as well, that it's a useful tool for them sometimes. So I don't know that there's as much. I think, you know, police unions certainly make a lot of noise about access to police misconduct records, but I actually don't know if there's as much controversy about it in general. So, you know, I think as long as we do the kind of verifiable reporting that we're doing about the misconduct, and there's not really any holes to poke there. And we're, you know, making a public resource for everyone, police included, if they want to use it. There really hasn't been that kind of significant pushback. Again, you know, knock on wood.
Sam, thank you so much for your answer, and thank you so much for your time. This is Sam Steklow from the Invisible Institute talking about their work on tracking police conduct, community work. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and good luck with everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.